It gives me great pleasure to introduce Bill C. from Los Angeles.
Hi, Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
It's really good to be here. I love England. Spent a lot of time there over the years and had a couple of businesses there. This is really great. And talk about three great talks. It just changed everything I'm going to talk about here. Those three people definitely should never drink again. That's my professional opinion, especially Nick. But it was really good to hear that. I mean, real down-home, straight-ahead Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't always hear that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about my drinking. Just have faith that I should never drink again. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. I'm 72 years old, so I've been sober about half my life. That's a long damn time. I am really impressed with that number. The reason I'm sober is because I work such a great program and I'm of above average intelligence and I've really applied myself well. If you believe that, I've got some property for you to buy too. When I got to AA, I was 37 years old and I had the emotional development then of probably about a 16 year old. And this kid was not an honor student. He's not the one that was mature beyond his years. You know, he's the one with a bit of a problem with authority. I believe that what's happening to us in sobriety is that we're growing up emotionally, and we skipped it when we were growing up. Most of us were medicated in our formative years. Most of us started drinking at 13, 14, 15, 16. Not everybody, but most of us were drinking in the U.S. our high school years, when the lessons really get handed out. Everybody that you ever hear tell a story in AA, whether it's sharing in a meeting or being the speaker, will talk about how long before they drank, they felt apart from. They felt separate, different, and weird. And we talk about that like it's an aspect of alcoholism, like that's a manifestation of our alcoholism. I don't believe that. I've raised some kids, and all of them are self-centered when they're little. All of them feel separate. All children think that they should look different than they do, that if they were more athletic, that if they look like that guy, they'd be better, that they, you know, all of us feel that way. That's part of growing up. The ego manifests itself at 2.5 years old. When kids, we call it the terrible twos. You know, they realize that when they cry, you come, that there's me and there's you, that there's a separation. Prior to that, they don't sense the separation. So the ego presents itself, and for the rest, it develops an identity. Its job is to separate us. Its job is to protect us from danger and to worry about things and try to understand what's happening around it. All of us feel that way. The problem is that you and I started drinking. We were seekers long before we ever knew it. We were seeking something other than where we were. We're trying to find a solution to a perceived problem. And we start drinking and we have a spiritual experience. Non-alcoholic people don't get the bang out of it. We do. They also don't set off a craving. When we start drinking, there's no craving for them. They don't have the mental obsession of when in between drinking bouts that they want to start drinking again. They don't have that. They also don't get the bang out of it that we get. If they got the bang out of it that we got, they would drink more. But they don't. We have some kind of an awakening. We get taller, we get more intelligent, we get whatever we get it. And the whole idea, I think, with the drinking thing was this horrible self-centeredness, horrible feeling of separateness that we had, and we drink and it goes away. I think the idea behind the drinking thing, if I remember correctly, was to have a couple of pops and then get out of the house and have some fun. Start enjoying life, you know, go get some sex, go to the party, talk to the girls or the boys, whatever, you know, I mean, I think that was the idea. I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party. I'm having sex, menage a uno. There's no one else in the room, right? I mean, this is where the party, where I ended up at the party. You know, like Nick went to jail and he should have gone to a mental institution. I went to the mental institution for you. You don't have to go there. I went, and then I went back because I liked it for a follow-up. And this was a lockdown, barbed wire on top of the fence mental institution, and I was 22 years old. That's where the parties, me ended up in the party. And I had another 15 years to go before I got sober. They're coming in young now. A couple of our speakers were pretty young. We're in their early 20s when they got sober. God bless you. God bless you. What Bill Wilson wanted, he wanted hospitals across the country, right? Remember, he went to Rockefeller looking for some money. He found this solution. He believed he had a solution, and he wanted to build hospitals. And now we have that. And we argue about it, and we think they don't handle it well. But recovery is available at all levels of our society now, where it wasn't for many, many, many years. A lot of people think that AA has lost its edge. I don't believe that. I've been involved in it for 35 years. I've traveled the world in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've done a lot of stuff, a lot of cool stuff. My sponsor has drugged me into things I would have never entertained doing. And I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is as live and well and vibrant and effective as it's ever been. I believe that. That's my experience. And I listen to your home group here, and I think it's working in your neighborhood from just the three talks I heard, from what people are talking about. What did you hear in those talks? You heard sponsorship. I think that's a big deal. And it doesn't exist everywhere else that you go. I heard steps. I heard a little bit of inventory stuff. I heard the amends process. I would imagine you people believe in the ninth step and actually doing it. I don't believe most people in AA really do the ninth step. You know, I've been around long enough where people walk up to me. They hear me do my little rant, and they come up, and they've got 20, 25 years sober, and they say, can we talk? And we have the conversation. And I ask them the question, well, have you done the work? Have you worked the steps? And they'll say, oh, yeah, I've done the steps. And then they stop, and there's a pause, and they say, but not like what you're talking about. I haven't done that. Now, what is it that I'm talking about? Some right-wing, fringe, radical thing within Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, like we talk about the big book thumpers. Well, what book would you like me to thump? You know, I mean, what is it? It says in the book, we have a way out upon which we can all agree. What is that? What is it? I believe it's the 12 steps. I believe people that aren't even doing the 12 steps agree that that is the way out upon which we all agree. Even those people. Now, you look at the situation now that we have around the world. The meetings, as we have known them, have been taken away from us. What is happening to the people that all they have is the meetings? That's what they have. That's what many people think, that what AA is going to meetings, that that's what AA is. I don't believe that. And Bill Wilson and Bob Smith and Fitzmayo and the rest of the boys in the late 30s, mid and late 30s, they didn't have any meetings. There literally were not any meetings. And the most of the meetings that existed were Oxford Group meetings, which was a religious organization, non-denominational Christian organization. The meetings we have today are fashioned after the meetings, you know, 10 or 20 minute lead and then participation, an hour and a half. They talked about sharing. They finally told Bill, stop bringing drunks into our Oxford group meetings. Go do your own thing. So there was a meeting in New York, and there were Oxford meetings in Akron, Ohio. That's it. They didn't have meetings to go to. They didn't have any clubhouses. There was no place to hang out. What were they doing? They were working with others. Now, here's what I would like to talk about. I got a few minutes here. And this came up in another meeting I did the other day. It says in our book, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this attitude has happened automatically. You heard that in the sharings before this. Like, it's easy not drinking. It's not a chore, right? We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. What is that? It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. So evidently, this program is a spiritual program. There's no spiritual side to it. At its core, it is spiritual in nature. And it says, evidently, we have laurels that we can rest on. I wonder what those are, right? We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So evidently, we've got a spiritual condition that needs to be maintained. My question is, and what I've been ruminating on lately, is what is that spiritual condition? What does it look like? And how do we achieve it? The other day, maybe 2 months ago, before all this shutdown happened, long before it, I spoke at a conference up in Sonoma in Northern California, above where I live. And it was a men's banquet, and I flew up there, and this guy picks me up. He's my host, and we're riding in the car to go to this place, and this guy was an older guy like me, and we're just talking away, and he asked me how long I'd been sober, and I told him, and he said to me, oh, I almost had 30 years. So you know that it's going to be an interesting conversation. And he says at 29 years and 9 months sober, he went out on pain medication. He had been in AA for a long time. He liked AA. His wife was a sober woman. They met in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had not really drifted away, but he wasn't going to as many meetings. He was just kind of hanging out and resting on his laurels. His attitude was what he told me. He says, you know, I'm not going to ever drink again. I have no desire to drink again. I'm never. This is, you know, I've got this. I've got it. This is cool. I've got it. And he had an injury of some sort, and they gave him some pain medication, and he was taking it as prescribed. And then one day, him and his wife are going to go to a wedding, and he took two pills instead of one so he would feel a little bit better at the wedding. And that started a downhill slide that lasted 3 years. Eventually, he started drinking, and everything turned to shit. And at the time he's talking to me, he's back again, and he's a couple of years sober. And he's got a commitment. He's driving the speaker around. You know, he's back in AA, and he's doing the thing. And we had a really interesting conversation. I mean, from the voice of experience, there is a lot of wisdom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what wisdom is? Wisdom is two things, the combination of two things. One is experience, which we all have. We have a lot of experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have an experience drinking, an experience in transformation, and an experience in sobriety and how to live sober. The second aspect of that is intellect, enough intellect to be able to describe the experience. Some of us speak in meetings, and all of us talk to each other, and what we are conveying is wisdom. And it certainly can be for the newcomer. We can give them lots of wisdom, and it also can be for people that have been around a while, you know, that are suffering. Suffering in AA. And there's a lot of people suffering right now, locked in their homes. Some of them are living with people they really don't like, and they're stuck with them, and they have no way to get out, and they're intimidated by the technology. They're afraid to do the Zoom thing. They don't understand it. Maybe they don't even have a smartphone, and they're stuck, and they're as in much trouble as any newcomer. So anyway, this guy tells me his story, and it really affected me. I really had a profound, I mean, this guy was not that different from me. I mean, he was like me, same age, same, you know, similar story, really. And then I fly back to California, and the next night I spoke at another meeting in local around here, and the woman was a 10-minute speaker before me, and she got up and talked about being 10 years sober and having it all figured out. She ends up drinking. Series of tragedies in her life, stuff happened. She started exhibiting some bad behavior, and here she is back in AA now for a year or two telling her story. And it just lit me up. I mean, those two things, it told me, Bill, pay attention. Because I'm 35 years sober, and I'm an official AA guru, man. I got this thing figured out. You know, I'm not any different than those two people, you know. And I got this thing figured out. I'm never going to drink again. I have no desire to drink again. I got this thing figured out. So what is spiritual condition? If that's what's going to keep me around here, if it's not going to be going to meetings, 875,000 meetings, you know, if that isn't it, what is spiritual condition? I think what spiritual condition is compassion. I think the basis of being good spiritual condition is having compassion. Self-centered people, egocentric people, don't have much compassion. And I look back on the years when I got sober, I had no compassion, and I did not know that I had no compassion. I've never had compassion. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience compared to the one that I'm having and realize that there's something wrong. Certainly, I have character defects. They're obvious. Arrogance, pomposity, rage. I was a rager, man. I rage. And I'm 6'5". And when I'm in good shape, I'm 230, 35 pounds. When I'm in bad shape, like now, kind of, I'm 250. So I can be intimidating. And at the time, I'm not smiling much, you know? I mean, I was a biker and, you know, all of this stuff. So I come here, how do I know I don't have compassion? I'm married for my second marriage. I got a couple of kids, you know, and I get sober and things are looking better. I'm working, you know, things are getting better. My life is getting better. And I'm in the house with these people, and I'm not connected to any living human being. I'm not connected. And I have no compassion. One of the manifestations of emotional immaturity certainly is self-centeredness. Now, when you see a teenager when he's 15, 16 years old, he's self-centered, all wrapped up in himself, it can be appropriate, sometimes even cute. When you're 40, it's just stupid. You know? When is little Billy going to grow up? When is he going to come out of this childish thing? You ever heard people in AA say, you know, never tell an alcoholic what to do. He doesn't like to be told what to do. Never tell him what to do. He'll just do the opposite thing. You know? Really? Still? Still? Yeah. I heard a guy one time say, I'm living, he's 40-some years sober. He says, I'm living proof that you can stay angry and still be sober. And I thought to myself, when I was new, I'd go, boy, there's something to shoot for. You know, I want to be like that guy, you know. So one of the manifestations of emotional immaturity is lack of compassion, is self-centeredness. Everything's happening to me. Another example of it, of immaturity, is when everything is someone else's fault. It's always someone else's fault. Now, there's a lot of conspiracy theory running around right now about what's going on. And you can usually tell the people that are really enamored and all wrapped up in the conspiracy theory is that there's comfort in thinking that there's a plot, when the truth is it's just random insanity. It's more frightening than you think it is. But when it's all happening to me, we try to understand it. We want to understand everything. We want to understand what God is. My experience is God is an experience. It's not a concept. Spirituality is an experience. It isn't a concept. So if everything is someone else's fault, you know, that you're the problem, this whole concept of powerlessness is really difficult for us. They said that we were just powerless over alcohol because they didn't want us to running down the street. My experience is it's everything. I have no power or control over anything. Certainly not you. And I keep talking to you. If you were just a little bit different, the two of us would be a hell of a lot happier. You need to change in order for me to be okay. You ever heard someone say, I had to leave that relationship because I wasn't getting my needs met? When I hear that, it just creeps me out. I always need to get my needs met. And my needs being met are dependent upon you. Man, that is guaranteed lifetime suffering. Because you just absolutely insist upon living your own life, and it pisses me off at my core. So this spiritual journey we on, we come in, we get sober, and miraculously, the obsession to drink and use gets lifted, really kind of before we do anything. It just kind of happens. I mean, the most miraculous thing that happened in my life was on March the 27th, 1985. And the longer I'm sober, I look back on that day, and what a stunning experience. It's 6 months sober when I did my fifth step. I realized, my God, it's going to be like this now. Now, I wasn't sure what this was, but I knew the old life was over. And so far, it's proved to be true. What a miraculous thing. The obsession gets lifted. When we do the inventory, the fourth and the fifth step, what are we looking for in that inventory? The fourth column, or the extended third, whatever your Talmudic understanding is of the step, you know, is what are my faults and mistakes? It doesn't even say my part. It says, what are my faults and mistakes? This is when we stop blaming other people for our problems. It seems one of the very basic steps for spiritual awakening, for spiritual understanding or psychic change, is it just has to stop being your fault. If it stays your fault, I'm never going to get well, ever. Anytime I'm disturbed, anytime, it's always my fault, it's not your fault. I hate that part. You know, I live most of my life, you know, blaming you for my problems. The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one because it's the only one I've ever known. And I can never take responsibility for my behavior because it's indefensible. So I do the inventory and I begin to crack that armor. I begin to crack that and look like, well, maybe it's me. You know, doesn't mean that things didn't happen to me, but if I'm still carrying around the resentment, the perpetrator doesn't feel my anger. I feel it. I mean, the first time my sponsor told me the people I hate don't feel it, that was news to me. I guess I thought that long. You ever hated somebody really good and you miss a day hating them, and you're going to hate them extra on the next day just to make up for the day you miss? That's resentment. So in the ninth step is when the transformation begins. When I go out and I see people I don't ever want to see again and I make the amends, when I turn and walk away from that, I am inexorably changed. That's when the transformation really happens. 1 through 9 is about 10% of the program. It's not the work. 10, 11, and 12 is the work. 10 is about self-awareness as compared to self-obsession. When I be able to watch myself move through life, there's a difference between that and self-obsession. When I'm aware, when I can see. In the 11th step, I can watch myself think. In meditation, I can focus on the breath. The mind will wander because it doesn't like being in the present moment. There's nothing for it to do. And then you notice that it has wandered and you gently bring it back to the breath. Absolute conclusive proof that who you are is not your thinking mind. That changes the entire game. I can finally stop working on myself. I'm just feeding the beast. When I understand what the present moment feels like, I notice when I'm not there and I can gently come back to it at any given time. And meditation is a really good vehicle for that, for understanding and living in that present moment. That's when compassion happens. When I start working with you in that 12th step, he starts sending me teachers. You are the teachers. If I want to confront my defects of character, I'll sponsor people. I'll run into every one of them. Whatever prejudice and opinion I have that I'm stuck in, it will walk across the room and ask me for help. All I have to do is let it in, and I'll have an opinion, and then I'll have an experience, and it'll change my opinion. That's called compassion. What that is compassion. I start feeling you in my life. And I'll leave you with this. They say around here, you got to give it away to keep it. No, not at all. You have to give it away to even get it. That's what it is. It is not about us at all. That is the demon, this concept and structure of who I think I am, and it needs to be defended. When you enter my life, that falls away. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Completely blinded, man.